You probably have told the story many times already, but I would love to hear that from you anyway. You are bringing how you got started in dancing and why you continued.
Yeah, sure. So I started salsa when I was approximately 10 years of age. So my parents at the time were attending classes just socially. They were not professional dancers. And because I didn't want to stay home alone, they didn't want to leave me alone. So they took me along with them, and I remember sitting on the side just waiting for them to finish their class. But I got curious. I started watching what they were doing, and then I started moving my feet under the table. And then one day my dad wasn't feeling well, so my mom was in need of a dance partner. And that's where I came along. So I was very young, and yeah, I just kind of joined for fun, not really thinking anything of it. I didn't have any plans or strategy or anything like that. I was too young, obviously, but I really enjoyed it. And it wasn't long after that where I met my dance partner of 20 years, Luda. I was about 11 and she was 10, and then she came to the same class in a similar situation. So she came with her parents, and then because I was 11, she was 10, they partnered us up. And again, little did we know it was going to last 20 years and multiple world championships down the track. When I was about 13, she was about 12, we started performing in a Brazilian group. So we were very young and we started gaining performance experience around Sydney. And then we started Latin ballroom dancing, and that's where we got our technical training and, competitive spirit. So it's one of those things where I was just really enjoying myself. And I used to do martial arts. I used to, play a lot of sports. But there came a point where I had to choose. I had to decide, okay, what did I want to invest my time in? And yeah, that's when I decided to pursue salsa. Yeah. It's a bit of a long-winded story, but
No, that's great. That's
yeah.
great. As far as competition goes, when did you decide to compete? Was it like a natural progression for you, or was there a sequence of events that led to that?
Well, I mean, in ballroom dancing, you don't really take on ballroom unless you're prepared to compete, because it's a very competitive style of sport and dance. So that was kind of expected. Once we started training in ballroom, we were automatically working towards competing. But at that point in time, there wasn't really much opportunities in salsa to compete. And then it wasn't until the year 2001, when the IDO World Salsa Championships, that's the International Dance Sport Organization, they held a salsa division within their championship. And there was an Australian qualifier. And that was the first time there was ever an Australian qualifier for anything overseas. And Luteran and I, we qualified, and then we went. And in our first international salsa championship, at the world level, we won. And we were very, 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 very surprised. We didn't expect that. But yeah, that was kind of our introduction to the, world salsa sort of championship stage.
Yeah, so you took advantage of the first opportunity, sounds
Yeah,
like.
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we had already been competing in ballroom, so it was in our, in our DNA, you could say. Yeah.
What was the most challenging and most rewarding part of the journey so far?
When you say the journey, are you still referring to competitively or what?
Yeah, when you started competing and when you went through all the championships and all the work, I'm kind of curious in that time frame.
Right. So I think in terms of like what was most rewarding, it's all the lessons that you learn along the way. So when it comes to competing, there's a lot of mindset involved, but I didn't really know this at the time, but I was kind of the experience was kind of molding me in a certain way. And when you compete, obviously you want to win. There's a large part of you that wants to win. But actually you gain more when you don't win, because it comes with a lot of lessons. And that's probably one of the most rewarding things for me looking back. This was not at the time, like when everything didn't go my way, I wasn't celebrating, but looking back, I have to say that, yeah, one of the most valuable sort of, I guess, byproducts of competing is the lessons that you learn along the way. If you're that way inclined, if you're somebody that is constantly sort of like constantly looking for the lessons, I think there's always lessons, but you need to sometimes look for them to find them.
Which ones did you find?
Yeah, so one of the biggest lessons was my metrics for success, like the way I measured success. So, from such a young age, where I was competing, and naturally you would expect to associate success with winning, especially if you're a competitively natured person. But that's actually not a very healthy way to measure success. And what happens with that is when you identify success with winning, and then you don't win, that winds up sort of causing you to believe you're a loser. Because it's very binary. It's like you either win or you lose. And there's kind of no gray in between. And that's where a lot of pain, a lot of unnecessary, sort of negative emotions can come in. So as I got older and more experienced, and actually, really, honestly, it took me about 20 years to learn that lesson. It wasn't until I actually won my 10th World Championship where I realized that all along I sort of the way that I was attributing success, could have been healthier. And so it became more about inspiring people as opposed to winning. And there's a lot of like validation as well that dancers tend to seek through putting themselves out there. And that's something thing else for me, like, sort of like realizing that, you know, the validation piece, like the piece where you're sort of looking outward for your sense of, how can I say, like, for your sense of self, I guess, you know, and how you're measuring yourself up against the world, that's not very healthy either. So, you know, I sort of realized once I was reaching the end of my competitive career that actually all along I was kind of just seeking this validation, which isn't very healthy again. And so, you know, it's much more powerful to get your validation from within, irrelevant of whether you win or you lose, or somebody likes you, somebody doesn't like you, a judge gives you 10 or 5, like all of that is external. So again, it's a bit of a long-winded answer, but yeah, I've you know, competing has really helped to, as I said, give me the lessons in order for me to become the person that I am today, and pass on my lessons to others so that they hopefully can avoid the, you know, the heartache, some of the heartache that that I went through, although, you know, those are where the lessons are. So yeah, I don't regret anything really.
No, I love that you shared that. Thank you so much for being able to share that, because you mentioned seeking validation from within. Do you think it's possible, because it sounds like you realize that after you've won your 10th title, which is a lot of time when you think about it, right? Do you think it's possible to have this realization or actually implement that realization when you haven't accomplished much?
Oh, absolutely. Of course. But it requires a certain person to sort of introspect, you know, to like, to go within, to seek answers, to ask questions, to, you know, not everybody is growth minded. You know, so, and I think there's a natural kind of maturing that sort of happens over time, you know. I mean, definitely these epiphanies and these kind of realizations, they can happen at any time in your life. So, you know, I know people in my life at the moment that are kind of going through what I'm going through, but they're like 10 years younger than me. So, you know, like everyone at their own time, you know what I mean? And I really believe that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And, you know, there's certain lessons that some people will never learn because they're either not that way inclined, or, you know, it's not of value to them, or, you know, they are, yeah, they're sort of, I guess, just caught up in the routine of day to day. And a lot of people don't even question who they are or how they are. They just are the way that they are, and, mm-hmm. and that's it. But, you know, yeah. Yeah, like if you're someone that is open to, you know, self-developing, not just in dance, but as a person, then you're not just the way that you are. Like, that's something that's malleable. Like, you can improve, you can change. Your brain has plasticity, you know right. what I mean? And yeah. But when you're young, you don't think about that. Like, when you're young, you just are the way that you are, and that's it. So, yeah, but I'm very fortunate and grateful to have that curiosity within myself. And it was about maybe 10 years ago that I started sort of on this journey of self-development, and my dancing and competing has been a huge part of that journey. Yeah.
No, this is awesome. The mental aspect of it is fascinating for sure. And I do agree. I think it takes a certain level of maturity or certain level of curiosity, perhaps, to sit with yourself and ask those questions, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would recommend it for everyone, but it's not for everyone. Like, you know, some people really find it difficult to just sit still. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's definitely, I mean, the world would be, I think, a better place if everybody would, you know, be able to sort of, you know, I guess, self-reflect. But everyone's, you know, unique in their own way, you know, and each at their own time.
What aspects of dancing came natural to you and what did not?
That's a good question. Like, I think because I started so young, my brain was like a sponge. So everything came relatively easy to me. And I know that it's not going to help many people out there. But it does help when you start young, definitely. You know, if you're, you know, slightly older, then sometimes your body has adapted to certain moving in certain ways, and it's like you have to kind of break habits, which can sometimes be more challenging. But I mean, that's one of the great things about salsa is there's really no defining age kind of, there's opportunities for everyone everywhere on any age, or time in their life. But for me, like, everything came relatively sort of fluidly, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why I gravitated towards salsa and why I always enjoyed it. You know, when I learned ballroom, that was quite technical. So, you know, salsa was more like fun and ballroom was more like more, I guess, disciplined training. And so I guess, you know, that there would have been some struggle, you know, like developing the techniques because they're not easy. But from a young age, I had this desire. I kind of knew that I wanted to become someone in the world of salsa. I had this kind of drive and this kind of like a knowing. I had this knowing that I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I just knew I was going to get there. And so that kind of pushed me forward, you know, and even if there were times where maybe it didn't come so naturally, I didn't even question, you know, whether I should stop or slow down because my vision was so kind of clear. So in hindsight, when I look back, there's no sort of like a one defining moment which was kind of challenging or like, as in, you know, with dance and what I was learning, everything was relatively natural for me. And my I come from a musical family, not necessarily dancers, but there's like musicians within my family, and so I guess I was always around music, and it just felt like it was the right thing for me to do. And I was very lucky to have supportive parents, very, very, very supportive parents. And they supported my dance. And there were times where I had to choose between finishing my schooling. And this is probably not good parenting advice, but they allowed me to pursue my dancing as opposed to finish my HSC, which in Australia is like your final examination for you to then go to university or, whatever. And at that point in time, I had this opportunity. I got a scholarship to train in London, to go to London and dance in ballroom. And it was a very prestigious scholarship, and but it meant I couldn't finish my schooling. And my parents supported my dance. They allowed me to go, to London and get the training that I needed. And so if they would have kept me in Sydney studying in school, like I don't know. I don't know if, the outcome would have been the same, but yeah, very lucky to have supportive parents, obviously, when you're young. Yeah. You got to be careful with me because I go off on a tangent. So
No, I love
if
it. I
I
love
sort
it.
of like, like just kind of pull me back, reel me back in
No, it's good
if I lose
because
the question.
no, it's good because it tells the story. There's probably some things that people did not know, that you're sharing.
I'm
So
sure
it's great.
there's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, so this is gold. So you mentioned you're coming from a musical family, and I believe, well, Neri mentioned it, so I know for sure that you played percussion instruments. When did you start that?
Yeah, so I don't recall ever really starting in the sense of like learning. It was again a very organic process. When I was young, I would watch and I would listen and go and see my dad playing bands, and so it was like this kind of osmosis. I was just learning without even realizing I'm learning. It's not like I sat down and had lessons, but I my first sort of I guess kind of real-time experience in percussion was when I was 16, and then I joined my dad's salsa band at the time. My father was in a salsa band in one of the Latin American nightclubs here in Sydney, and I was underage, so I wasn't even allowed to be there. But I don't know how, but because my father was in the band, and I was this kind of flamboyant young dancer, they wanted me there. And so yeah, I joined a band when I was 16 for a couple of years, and I was playing just bongo and campana. And then when I was 18, I got another gig with another band, separate to my father, in another nightclub. And then I did that for a couple of years, and that was playing timbal. So so from like 16, from about the age of 16, I started playing in bands. And now I just freelance, and I play in various different bands. And whenever I travel and there's a band, like an international band, I'll always like try to jump up and grab something to play. And yeah, I love it. It's really like, for me, the music side of it is very meditative. It's like it puts me in a bit of a trance when I'm up there. And yeah. I really think everybody needs something like that in their life, something that really zones them out. For some people, it's rock climbing. For some people, it's like, I don't know, painting. It could be anything, but everyone needs something that just really enables them the ability to disconnect from whatever's going on in their life.
So it sounds like you don't even necessarily have a point of reference dancing without playing like percussion instruments. You've always been around it.
Yeah, they're very enmeshed. Enmeshed, correct. Yeah.
That's very interesting. With playing percussion instruments, are you able to recognize patterns? Like when you hear, let's say, maybe a song that you don't know, and you do the regular count. Oh, by the way, actually, also, there's a different count, right? There's count of four for a musician versus count of eight for a dancer. Does that ever mess with your brain?
No. No, it doesn't. I mean, you know, musicians kind of like find it a little bit funny, like that Salcedo's counting eights. But, you know, being a dancer and musician, I understand, like, the reason why we count in eights is because it allows us the ability to break down the two sides of the basic. So we have like a left side and a right side of the basic. And mm-hmm. so when we have different numbers, it allows us to easily attribute the number to the step. If you count in fours and I say, okay, on one, you're going to say, which one? Is it the left one or the right one? So, you know, it just saves us a lot of time to count in eights. But I actually remember like the evolution of the counting. I remember like many years ago seeing a DVD of Josie Neglia, I think it was. And maybe don't quote me on this, but I remember the counting being something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, but they're holding, like there's a hold. So clearly they're counting the steps, not the music. They're just counting how many steps they're taking. And, you know, and then I saw it kind of evolve into what it is today. It's the same thing in other styles, like Zouk as well, you know. Zouk used to be boom, chick, chick, boom. That's how they used to count. Boom, chick, chick, boom, chick, chick, boom. And I remember thinking, okay, when does the foot actually land on the music? And so I was like, 1, 3, 4, and then 5, 7, 8. Okay. And now everybody's using numbers. So it's like, it's very interesting when you look back to seeing how things evolve. So it wasn't always the way that it is today.
So yeah, correct and, me. And, go sorry, ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Eddie Torres had a big, you know, influence, obviously adding structure, you know, to what salsa is today. So, yeah, and there's a few key sort of, you know, individual sort of artists. I wouldn't even be able to name them all, but I know that, like, there's certain technicians out there, you know, they're like, you know, because you have dancers and then you have teachers. And because you're a great dancer, it doesn't mean you're going to be a great teacher. And that's a very different set of skill set. But there are some fantastic teachers out there, and they have helped in, you know, developing the structure of the dance that's today, you know. So, and, you know, obviously, like, I like to think I'm one of them, but but I'm not going to claim to be.
With percussion, I'm just going to kind of give you my guesses, or like educated guesses based on what I've gathered so far. It seems to be the backbone of the music, of the way the band plays, is because it seemed to be the section of the band that signals what comes next. Am I kind of on the right track there?
You know, I'm Might be treading on a few toes here if I start saying it's the backbone, because you know, like obviously, if you speak to any musician that plays a certain instrument, they're going to have a different opinion as to where the backbone is, right? But certainly the rhythmic section of the band, I mean, like salsa wouldn't be what it is without it, right? But then again, that goes with the piano. That goes with the brass, that like everything ultimately culminates. But if you go back to, you know, if you go back in history, you know, everyone's like all accounts of history are going to lead back to Africa in some way or another. And they didn't have brass, they didn't have piano, they had drums. So like if you think back to like that sort of, you know, age, then yes, the percussion is the heartbeat. You know what I mean? Yeah, but in terms of like, you know, which section cues, there is often like a director, you know, like someone that directs the song. So usually that might be the lead singer. But sometimes it's the timbalero, one of the percussionists, and he cues, you know, where the song goes. And when? So, yeah.
With the reason I ask that too, because you know, lately I've been listening more salsa, and I'm noticing as time goes by, I'm starting to noticing sounds from percussion section that normally, you know, precede the change in the song or precedes a break or something like that. And it's sort of like distinct little sound, like tudum, something else strong like that distinct from other sounds. And that's the reason I was wondering about it, because the earlier I was starting to ask a question. If you dance to a song that you're not familiar with, are you able to pick some patterns and kind of know where it's going based on your either percussion experience or just the musical experience in general? So I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you immerse yourself more in musicality and you sort of learn more of what's going on within the music, then that does give you a bit of insight into, you know, the composition, the structure, and sort of like commonalities between song to song. And definitely, like I said, the timbalero, he cues the section, right? It might not be like physically, so like with his hand. So there might be, let's say, for example, a singer, and the singer will tap the head. And when he taps the head, he wants the song to go to the mambo or the monya. And then once he does that, the timbalero then does like a second cue. And so that sort of cue is very audible. You can hear it. And he cues the band, and then the brass comes, and you know. And off the band goes. But you know, I always teach that when dancers don't know a song and they want to dance musically, it becomes less about preempting and more about being in reaction to. It's very important to not try to preempt everything, because then you're just going to be in a constant state of stress. Yeah. So, you know, when you don't know a song, you just want to relax and you just want to be able to follow along, you know, and the act of following or reacting means that there has to be a delay. There's a delay in your reaction because you are following. So there's an action and then there's a reaction. So there's a time lapse difference. And a lot of dancers, you know, when I teach that, that really kind of like helps them to just calm down.
So basically you're saying not to worry to hit everything on one after the break. Just if you go on 5, 6, 7, that's okay, right?
Well, I even teach dancers to react 8 counts later. So not even five, like not even like 4 counts later, but 8 counts later, or even 16 counts later, like whatever they need. So yeah, it really isn't about hitting everything. That's just a very kind of I guess, ignorant way of thinking of musicality. And when I say ignorant, I don't mean it in a like a, you know, any kind of negative. It's just ignorance basically just means you're not aware, you know. So yeah, but when you become more aware and you start educating yourself, then yeah, you learn that it's not really about hitting everything. Yeah, in fact, that probably has the opposite effect. That will deter dancers from dancing with you.
Oh, interesting. Why you think that?
Well, because there's no fluidity. If you're trying to hit everything, like, you know, I imagine it would be difficult to have any kind of, I guess, flow. You know, you would be like stop and starting all the time. You've got to be able to ride through in order to highlight. Like it's very simple. Think of like if you see a garden of roses, you're not going to notice the one rose that's in the middle of the garden of roses. For you to notice one rose that's in the middle, the rose has to be surrounded by nothing. So it has to be like grass and then a rose, and then you'll see the rose. But if you see like 100 roses, you kind of lose the appreciation of the single rose. So when you want to highlight something, you need to not highlight other things. Does that make sense? You need to be able to ride through. You need to be able to, as I said, just have a sense of fluidity. And then when you want to highlight something, then it's very highlighted because you weren't trying to highlight everything. Makes sense?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense.
It's called light and shade. Yeah.
Well, this is so interesting because, so I wonder also, like, as far as highlight, because, okay, so I've seen some of the Kalena dancers, and they would hit all these different micro sounds, you know, within the song. And I don't know if it's just how they stylistically doing it, or it was just a showcase of that particular choreography or that song. But it looks very, like, not just effective, it looked like captivating. Very entertaining and very fun. So would you consider that, like, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like the way that, like, sometimes they dance and hit like every beat of the drum. Would you consider that highlighting everything, or is just that's a different way to dance altogether?
Look, you're kind of making these broad, like what you saw, I don't know what you saw, right? So I guess you're generalizing. Mm-hmm. You're generalizing that the Kalenios, they hit everything. I would say they don't hit everything. You have this impression that they're hitting everything. And obviously their feet are moving fast, so you kind of make these connections like they're hitting everything. But there's a difference between what you see on stage and then what you see on the social floor. You know what I mean? So what I was referring to was more about social dancing. You know, the focus on when you dance socially needs to be on the connection between you and your partner and, of course, the music, but not at the expense of you and your partner. So when the focus goes too much to the music and not enough to your partner, then it can become segmented, like it's less wholesome and it becomes more like separate, you know what I mean? Less fluid. Yeah, and when you watch things on stage, like there is definitely like people out there that they overcomplicate musicality. Like it's overly musical, like in a sense where you can't appreciate anything. It's very difficult. And that doesn't mean that, like, one of my most famous solo routines is Caribe. It's Miquel Camillo, a piano player, and I do this piano piece, and everybody comes up to me and says, "Oh my God, you hit everything with your feet. You hit everything with your feet. It's amazing. It's like you're the piano." Yeah, that's definitely, like, in that particular number, that's one of the intentions. You know what I mean? But when I social dance, I don't try to hit everything with my feet, and, like, yeah, no. So, yeah. So there's always context, you know? There's always context to things, and it's important to, I believe it's important to try to be a well-rounded dancer. You know, at least that's something that I've tried. So, to be a good social dancer, plus competitor, plus performer, plus teacher, plus business owner, plus mentor. Like, they're all different skill sets, and I've really, tried to excel at whatever I'm doing. I try to really encompass that. And just understanding that one is different from another.
It's a great distinction and great point because, if you're doing a choreographed piece, that's not going to be the same as social dancing. That's two different
Absolutely
modalities.
not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's many great teachers out there that are not really the most inspiring dancers to watch. There's many great dancers that you can't actually understand what they're saying when they teach, or maybe they have no idea what they're doing. There are many great dancers, inspiring, that find it difficult to break things down because it's a different skill set. And then because you love dance, it doesn't mean you're going to love owning a dance school.
Of course.
It's like chalk and cheese. And people make that mistake. They make that mistake all the time. They assume that because you're good at one, you're going to be good at another.
You mentioned connection. What else a wonderful experience for social dancing, in your opinion?
Sorry, you just cut out a bit. What was that? The question?
What would make you feel, if you had a social dance with someone, what would make you feel this was a great dance? What are the things that need to be present?
Well, I would say there's three sort of main, it's like the triad of connection. So there's the connection of you and your partner, so physically, like your hand-to-hand connections, right? And obviously they're good, they're relaxed and fluid, and you have good lead follow dynamics. Then there's the musical connection that you each have with the music and with each other, right? So there's the physical connection, there's the connection to the music, and then the third one is what I call emotional connection. And emotional connection is that sort of like that acknowledgement of your partner, that validation that you're dancing with someone and you make them feel like they are your focus and your center of attention for those 5 minutes. Because sometimes you can have good lead follow and good musicality, but then it's like one dancer is off with the fairies and one dancer is off on the clouds. Like, and it's like, hey, hello, hey guys, hey, do you wanna like look at each other like once? Just maybe once? Really, like I see that a lot. And they're good dancers. Like, I remember once I was in Peru and I was in a club and just watching this guy dance, and he was great. This guy was flavorsome and just like, but completely oblivious of his partner. Like, and then I was just thinking, poor thing. I kept thinking to myself, poor girl. Like he might as well just have been dancing by himself. And there's a lot of that, and that's not good. So for me, it's those three. It's the physical, the music, and then the that sort of like visual, emotional, it's up here. It's like head to head. You know, the hand to hand, and then the head to head, right? So yeah, and when you have those three, it doesn't have to be like a super advanced level dance. In fact, I just really enjoy just cruising. I can have great dances even if the girl is like intermediate level. As long as those three are there, it's super, super enjoyable.
Social dancing is supposed to be relaxed, right?
Yeah, it's of course, it's supposed to be relaxed. But I think students fall into this trap. They fall into this trap of seeking confidence by learning steps and trying to emulate what they see on Instagram. And a lot of what you see on Instagram is actually for the sole purpose of inspiring and gaining followers. Okay? So there's a difference between, like, you know, watching a couple in Mexico on stage busting out these turbocharged turn patterns, mm-hmm. and then what your partner is going to appreciate being led into on the dance floor. Like, most of what's out there circulating on the internet is actually not very user-friendly.
Mm.
Like, when I say user-friendly, mm-hmm. I don't mean like it's not like leadable, but it might be leadable to the 1%. Or maybe 2%.
Right.
You know, that very small, minute, like very upper tier, fine. But to the 98%, it's not fine. And yet a lot of students, they try really hard to be that. And then it winds up causing bad leaders, like bad connection, injuries. And then what happens is followers think that's normal. And then they start to expect that. it's just this cycle. It's this cycle, right? Yeah. And look, that's no disrespect, like, because everyone has their place, right? And everyone has their strengths. So, like, when I go to festivals and I teach, I just teach basics half the time. But I love it because I feel like people need that, right? And there's a difference between what people need and what they want. And sometimes people don't know, they don't know what they need.
Right.
Right? They want chocolates and sweets. But what's good for them is broccoli and peas. You understand? So a lot of times I feed people their vegetables. But that's because That's something I pride myself in. I value that in my own dancing, the importance of fundamentals and basics. And yeah, that's what makes me. It doesn't mean I can't do the other stuff, but I choose not to. But there are other artists, that's what they're good at. They're good at like those crazy, inspiring, fast combinations, and it's like incredible to watch. It's amazing, and it inspires people, and that's important, to inspire people. It's very important. It's just there's such a big gap between like them and then usually where students are. And in order for them to get there, they often need to revisit their basics. Like it's like a saying, not a saying, but something I observe is that beginners almost always do intermediate classes. So anytime I'm teaching an intermediate class, there's a bunch of beginners in there. And then intermediates almost always do advanced classes. So when I'm, teaching an advanced workshop, I look around, the room's full of intermediates, okay? But what happens is there's a point where dancers get to like they hit like a plateau, they get like to an upper level, and then they realize, holy crap, I've got to go back to beginners. And so a lot of advanced actually do that. A lot of advanced, they realize at that point, oh, now I get it. I probably shouldn't have like accelerated my learning so fast. I should have just like slowed down. But like that's just part of the sort of maturing of dance that happens. Over time, it's like people, kids full of energy. They just want to do everything. They just want to do everything. They just want to do everything. And they want to eat everything and they eat sweets and blah, blah, blah. Salseros are like that when they learn. They just want to do everything, blah, 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 and this and that. And they throw the hand and throw the hand and kick the hand and punch the hand and duck the head and dip the girl. One, two, three, dip, dip, dip. They just want to do everything. They're very excited. But then there comes a point later in life where you realize, oh, okay, like maybe I should like breathe. Maybe I should just like chill out, take a chill pill. And yeah, so when I look back at my dancing, like when I was younger, I don't dance the way I dance today. Like I've evolved over the years, and yeah, it's kind of a natural progression,
Of course.
yeah.
So, thank you for sharing this. This is
That's
definitely
okay.
super valuable.
I got a bit excited
No, it's good.
there.
It's good. I love it. I love it. You have
Okay.
Dance Academy in Sydney, and you also offer some online training. Will you tell people more about it, how people can actually train with you?
Okay. So I've got an on-demand website, which is oliverpanita.dance. That's got a few hundred online videos that people can access at any point in time. It's got lots of information there, body movement, musicality, tone patterns, shines. It's there. Then I do live online classes as well, every Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Australian Standard Eastern Time. And that's part of my academy program where I teach body movement and musicality every Saturday, and people can log on live to those classes. You've got those two avenues there. And then lastly, for anybody that's very keen, I'm always available for online one-on-one private, tutorials. And they're very valuable, like to be able to get that personalized feedback. It can really accelerate a person's dancing. So my Instagram is Oliver Panita Dance. My school here in Sydney is Latin Motion Dance. So those are my two Instagram accounts. But definitely Oliver Panita Dance is the way to follow me. And then, if anyone's interested, they can just reach out and find out more information or, any way that I can support. I'm happy to do so.
With those live Saturday classes that you mentioned, do they go in some particular time periods? Like anyone can join any class, or how does that work?
So there's four classes, and anyone can join any of those classes. Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so all the information is on my website. So oliverpanita.dance is my on-demand website, but there's information there about my live classes as well. And latinmotion.sydney is my school here. And if anybody wants to ever log on live, that's the website they're going to go to. But I can give all the information if anybody reaches out to me personally.
Perfect. That's perfect. Well, anything else you would like to add in closing?
Not really, just thank you for having me. It's really I'm always very grateful to still be in the circuit, because I'm now one of the older generation sort of dancers. There's a whole bunch of new people up and coming. When I started, I was looking up to people like Frankie Martinez and Santo Rico, Yamule, like Sion Stylus, like even further back, like these guys. They were already around. Johnny Vasquez, another one, Eddie Torres, like they were already around. And I remember, like, when I went to New York and trained a little bit with Eddie, and as a student, I was in the class with Adolfo next to me as a student. We were both just like following Eddie, and I'm like, oh, hi, what's your name? Oh, Adolfo, what's your name? Oliver, okay, nice to meet you. And this was before any of us were anything. And I remember Eddie invited us to his team, but I had to go back to Sydney, but Adolfo stayed. And it's been beautiful seeing, like, you know what I mean? Like, just, yeah, seeing the dancers like around my generation. But now there's a whole bunch of newcomers, which is wonderful. But there's always that new thing, the new person, the new, right? In this world. But it's really humbling for people to still bring me to their festivals. I live in Australia. Like, this is literally the opposite side of the world, and it's very expensive to bring me. So anybody that brings me, it's because they really value me. You could bring like four European artists instead of just me. So, I'm still very, very humbled and grateful to be traveling, and to still sort of be given that recognition, that credit. It's really beautiful. Very grateful. I never take, I guess my skill sets, my talents for granted. And right now I just get a lot of joy out of giving back. Now it's all about creating champions and, helping people to better their life, not just in dance, but just in general, and passing on my lessons. And yeah, so I'm just very, happy and thankful that you invited me to this interview. Much appreciated. I hope to see everyone somewhere around the world soon.
Likewise, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to speak with you. Thank you for your knowledge. Thank you for your wisdom, and thank you for your perspective. I hope we'll have another opportunity, and I wholeheartedly hope that I will get to meet you one day in person. So thank you, Oliver, and take care.
All right. Take care, guys. Thanks a lot. Bye. Bye.